Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Up all night here on 5 Live with me, Richard Foster. It's definitely time that we started to talk tech. I've been cursing your screen, debating an upgrade, or just wondering how to follow the Olympics. Fevzi Turkalp from the website gadgetdetective.com can help. Hello there, Fevzi.
Morning.
How are you doing? You all right?
Yes, good, thank you.
Good stuff. I've got a tech problem already. My text console stopped working here. So if you want so I'm trying to read the text out and nothing's working yet, but you can tweet us at BBC5Live on the tweets on Twitter. You can text us on 85058 once my computer comes back to life, and you can call us now on 0500 909 693. That's 0500 909 693. We'd love to talk to you anything tech related, any tech problems you're having. Hopefully we've moved on a bit from Windows 10, Fevzi, because we've been discussing that for months and months and months. You'd think people
it's
might have...
It's just the gift that keeps giving,
well, it
isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. I tell you what happened with me and that. You know, I mean, having done these tech phone-ins, I thought, shall I do it? Shall I not? What shall I do? And I've got a... My laptop is 5.5 years old. And I thought, this might be a bit risky, because my theory in the past, as I think we've discussed, has always been, you know, if you're going to get a new version of Windows, wait for a year till all the bits and bobs have been sorted out, and then head out and buy yourself a new PC with it included, and
yes,
then you won't go far wrong.
Spot on.
So I mean, that sounds like it's still a fairly good theory, and certainly from the practice that I had with the laptop, it would still seem to be a kosher way of going about things, because I mulled around for ages, and of course you keep getting this little reminder saying, would you like to upgrade to Windows 10? And I kept saying, no thanks, I'm all right. And then it got to about the last week when it was still free, and I thought, oh, I'll give it a go. So I got the computer up and running, got it all sort of ready to upgrade, pressed the upgrade button, and it runs along and it runs along, and then it gets to 99% and stops, and it just stays there. It must have been 6-7 hours, and it was still at 99%, and yeah, Nothing else happened, and that was it. And I just thought, I'm going to go back to my original theory. So, I mean, was that fairly typical of the kind of experiences we've had here on these up all night phone-ins with the tech problems?
I mean, I wouldn't say that's typically what happens, but you know, I've heard that story many times of the upgrade freezing. Other people have successfully upgraded, but then realize that actually it's not for them, and then when they've tried to roll back, which is a facility for, I think you were getting about a month in which you could roll back to your earlier operating system, the rollback wasn't working and machines were being left bricked, effectively unable to function, neither one thing nor the other, as it were. It's a very tricky thing to do an upgrade of an operating system. I mean, it's a very intricate thing that the computer is trying to do. It's a bit like trying to perform a brain transplant on a person whilst that person's still conscious and functioning, and it's kind of not advisable to do these things on the fly, and it should be done with preparation, and as I'm sure we've said before, you know, backing up your machine so that if worse came to the worst and it all went wrong, you could roll back. One of the best ways of doing that, by the way, is if you've got an older machine and you're tempted to go to Windows 10, now that's an ideal point in time to insert an SSD, a solid state drive, into the computer as an upgrade. Take the old drive out with, say, Windows 7 on it, upgrade onto the new SSD drive, so that once you've done that, it will be faster as well as Windows 10. And then if it all went really badly wrong, you could just unplug the SSD and plug in the old drive, and the computer will never know that you did anything slightly satanic to it, as
I
it were.
I see.
So it's a good time to an operating system upgrade, if you are going to do it, is a good time to combine it with something like an SSD upgrade, because your old drive becomes the backup, and it's a perfect backup, because actually it's original.
Is it generally a reasonable thing to think the older the computer, the more difficult a massive upgrade like that is likely to be?
Yeah, it's more likely to struggle in terms of the availability of solid drivers for the machine. So for those that don't understand what that means, any computer needs to have bits of software that describe to the computer what all the bits of the computer are. So what type of graphics circuitry does it have? What type of sound circuitry does it have? What sort of printer is it attached to? All of these are identified to a bog standard operating system. Your computer is different from everyone else's. So it needs those drivers in order for it to understand the computer that it is and work well with Windows 10. But the older the machine, the less likely you are to have drivers that are fully compatible. And also the more likely you are to be running software that will also have a problem. It's not just a question of the hardware not being compatible. You may be running older versions of the software that then won't work. And if you rely on that, like a lot of old accounting software, you know, runs in old compatibility modes of old operating systems, and Windows 10 often doesn't support them, and suddenly you lose access to, you know, something that's core to your business, for example, and that can be devastating.
Mm. I think I read a story about one woman sued Microsoft because her computer just became dead.
Yeah.
Nothing, you know, it got... The upgrade happened, but then nothing worked. Nothing happened at all.
That's right. She was an estate agent in California, was upgraded according to her, without any knowledge of even what Windows 10 was. She said, not only did I not consent to Windows 10, I didn't even know what it was. And one day she came in and her computer was no longer working. It had been bricked by this upgrade. And she was able to successfully sue Microsoft for $10,000, and that was for the cost of a new machine plus loss of business. And she was able to quantify her losses in a way that a lot of home users can't. And it was very interesting that Microsoft was going to appeal and then settled.
Right.
They paid, and I'm rather curious as to why they did that. But I think in part as a result of that, they sort of backed off the quite so heavy-handed upgrade regime that they'd put into place previously, where people were getting upgraded pretty much against their will and certainly without their active consent. And they sort of backed away from that a little bit. And so I think that, you know, I think that's on the money. Interestingly enough, there was, we say we're not going to talk about Windows 10, but Windows 10 recently broke the latest upgrade, the anniversary upgrade, because Windows 10 is now a year old, it broke a load of people's webcams. I mean, millions of users' webcams suddenly stopped working.
Right.
Didn't physically break them, but it stopped supporting. There's a codec, there's a video codec, which is a way of encoding video into a form that can be compressed and transmitted, called H.264. And they basically removed support for 8.6.264 in this upgrade without telling anybody, and broke the functioning webcams of all these people. Interestingly enough, including Skype, which is a Microsoft product. So a lot of people who were using Skype suddenly couldn't do video calling anymore because Microsoft did this slightly iffy upgrade, to say the least.
Like you say, it is the gift that keeps on giving. I think we may try to move on from Windows 10, but
we'll
No, in the next 45 minutes, I think we will have a couple of issues raised by Windows 10. But you can call us on 0500 909 693 if you'd like to chat. We'd love to speak to you about your tech concerns with Febsy. Robert in Bristol has done just that. Hello there, Robert.
Good morning, James.
Hi, you have a mobile and a problem downloading some music. What's the problem?
No, right, I've got myself a Vodafone 7 Smart, number 7, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I've done, I went onto the internet to download some app books from my amazing Legacy of the Beast. Now, the download's great, but it won't let me open the file.
So it's not that you've downloaded the file, but then you can't open it?
You can't open it.
What could be the problem, Febsy?
So the main problem with... I didn't catch all of that question, I have to be honest, but the main problem with not being able to open files, be they music or anything else, is that files of, let's say, a music file can be of different formats. There are different ways of encoding and storing those files, and you need to have a player, a music player in your case, that's capable of dealing with that file type. So it may be that the standard music player on your device won't support it.
I am made and I brought out Legacy of the Beast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And doing film and stuff. Now, they've also brought out a book All the drawings and everything like that, I've done it. And that's what I'm trying. That's what I'm doing. I've tried to download all the people, the drawings, etc. But it says the file won't open.
Well, Robert, I mean, there's one other possibility. The possibility is that the file is corrupt, in which case you can try and delete it and download it again. But more likely, the file is of a format which you haven't got a program currently installed on your device that can actually understand that format. So for example, if it was a PDF file, a portable document file, .pdf, then you'd need a program on your device that can open and read PDFs, and there are many of those that can be downloaded. Similarly, it may be another type of file which is a bit more unusual. So I think what I do is try and discern what sort of file it is, and then look for a player that can actually, or a program that can actually open and display that file. So it's almost certainly a compatibility issue. There's a file type that currently you haven't opened before and haven't been able to open before on your device, and you'll need to find a compatible piece of software for that. But probably the best thing is to go back to the site where you download it from and see if you can determine what the file type is. And there may even be some help pages there that tell you what will actually allow you to play it back.
That's cool. Thank you.
All right, Robert. Good luck with that.
Well, Fevzi, I mean, we know that there's been plenty of topical stuff today about the changes to the licence fee and the closing of that loophole, which for ages people have been able to, essentially, if they've wanted to, they've been able to watch iPlayer content without the need for a TV licence. That loophole's now been closed, and there's been quite a lot of media coverage about that. But Ian asks on a text, how will it actually affect people watching iPlayer content on phones and computers and the internet?
Okay, so with the change in the law, what it means is now that if you watch BBC content online, and previously you didn't need a license because you weren't watching any live TV on a TV set, if you now have to have it because you're watching BBC content online, it doesn't actually matter what device you're viewing it on. And it's not just iPlayer, by the way, it's any one of any number of BBC websites where you can download or stream BBC content from. So it's not just iPlayer. It doesn't matter if you are accessing iPlayer or another BBC site via a tablet, a smartphone, a desktop PC, a set-top box. Even, for example, and this has been a point of confusion, iPlayer is available on a lot of platforms such as Sky or Virgin Media or Apple TV or so forth. And some of those platforms, people are already paying subscriptions to. Obviously, they pay a subscription to Sky or Virgin for the use of their personal video recorder and their software and their content. But that doesn't mean you don't need a license. If you access the iPlayer, even on a Sky box or a Virgin Media box, if you access the content online, you now need to have a license, and that's kind of important to note. There are some interesting distinctions also about how this works. So, for example, if you have a license at home, you know, the law recognizes that, you know, people watch content on their mobile phones or tablets, and not always when they're at home. So the law now says that if, for example, you go around to a friend's house, you can legally watch on your tablet or your smartphone, or in fact any device that doesn't need to be plugged into the mains. But as soon as you are viewing content on a mains operated device away from your home, then that address also needs to have a BBC TV license.
I can see a loophole in that already, or I can see a potential problem. What if your phone or tablet is charging when you're watching the iPlayer? Does that count as it being mains powered?
Well, look, I think the biggest hole in all of this is the enforceability. Frankly, to answer your question, strictly speaking, once it's powered from the mains and you're watching it at the same time, I think at that point that address needs a license.
Right,
or that, how they would ever know is another question. And what was interesting was that I think the Sunday Times, or the Times, I beg your pardon, was asking the question about what access to the information that the BBC could have, because obviously internet service providers have information about what websites and services we access and could tell quite easily, you know, whether we were accessing iPlayer. But this legislation doesn't give the BBC any powers to request or demand that information from internet service providers or from anywhere else, which means that it's not going to be very easy to enforce this by the BBC in any way. There's no verification. So when you go onto iPlayer, you are now asked, you know, if you have a TV license, and you answer yes or no. Mm-hmm. And if you answer yes, then iPlayer works. If you are answering yes and you're lying, then obviously you're committing an offence, and you could be looking at a £1,000 fine plus legal costs, unless you're in Guernsey, in which case £2,000, or Jersey, in which case it's £500. So I'm not sure why. So
regional differences.
Yeah, if you want to go and break the law, do it in Jersey. it's much cheaper.
But that's been a motto for years, but yeah. On various different topics.
Yeah, but I think that what this is about is it's a first step. Okay, this is to say, look, it was never intended to be the case that services like iPlayer could be used as a way of accessing content which is, you know, produced through license fee payers' money without having to contribute towards that. It is that the technology overtook the legislation. And, you know, if you think about it, there's no real important distinction between how you watch a program. It is whether you watch a program that is important, and therefore it's probably right and fair, although I understand not popular, that people who enjoy BBC content should pay for it. By the way, if the only BBC content you enjoy is BBC Radio, you still do not need a license. This is only for television.
Yeah,
you don't need a license if you're only enjoying radio. And also, if you're not enjoying BBC content, or at least not accessing BBC content, but you're accessing other catch-up services, again, you don't need a license. It's not like the television. With your television set, doesn't matter if you actually never watch the BBC. If you've got a TV set and you watch other content, you have to still pay. And then we went through that process of people claiming that they had a TV, but they never watched the BBC. And, you know, case law basically said that didn't wash. If you have a TV set, it's capable of receiving BBC content, then you had to have a license. But I think that this is the first step whereby, you know, the law is now saying, look, you know, If you're watching BBC content, you have to pay. If we see, I think over the coming years, if we see that there's a widespread abuse of the system and people are basically fraudulently watching, then the government has already mooted that it could introduce a white paper that would not only require people to say they have one, but to verify that they have a license. Now that might mean that there were some privacy concerns with that, depending on how they did it. The plus side is, if we could have verification as part of it, then it would allow the BBC to unblock access whilst abroad. Mm. So at the moment, when you go outside the United Kingdom and you want to stream access or get download or stream access to iPlayer or other BBC services, you can't, because the assumption is most people abroad are not BBC license fee payers. But some of us are. When we travel, we like to be able to access the service that we've paid for. It shouldn't matter. So if you have a verification process, then you could have a system whereby, you know, you as a license fee payer could go to France or Italy or Germany or wherever and watch your BBC content, but those aren't licensed fee payers abroad cannot.
Colleagues here have just said, you know, I mean, the simplest thing, obviously, when you get a TV license, it comes with a serial number. When you get to a login screen with the iPlayer or whatever sort of outlet you're looking at, you put that serial number in, and you put, and then a password or something like that. Bob's your uncle. Seems the clearest way.
The difficulty is that because you're now dealing with mobile devices, what would stop anybody from publishing a serial number that everyone could then use? Because you can't link that serial number to a static IP address, an internet address which is unique to a property, because as we've just mentioned, you're allowed to view on mobile devices, and that internet protocol address, that unique address, will be different at different times and in different locations. So it is tricky, and that's why I said that there may be some privacy issues, that if they try and they might be on a hiding to nothing with this, because, you know, the more, you know, what seems conceptually an easy thing to do can in practice be very complicated to achieve with reliably and without encroaching on people's rights. It's a bit like, software copyright protection.
Mm-hmm.
There's always ways around it, and as it's this sort of arms race between software producers and pirates, and what happens is that the honest user gets caught in the middle, that they pay for software or a license to use software, but actually it ends up not working, or they start having to pay for dongles and they can only use it on one device at a time and have to switch, you know, all these sort of intricate solutions designed to protect the interests of intellectual property owners, in this case the BBC. If they go too far in trying to protect that, then they spoil the experience for the legitimate user in trying to deny the illegitimate user access. And I fear that's what would happen. And I think that's why essentially people are on their honour at the moment. But be aware, you know, if you do get caught, it can be a large fine, and it's not just £1,000. You could end up paying court costs, and that can run into a lot of money as well.
Yeah, it's a real balance, isn't it? 0500 909 693 for your calls. Let's speak just before the headlines to Peter in Cramlington in Northumberland, who I understand, Fevzy, you spoke to a few weeks back about a cloud book. He's got a bit of an update for you. Go ahead, Peter.
Hello, Richard Fevzy.
Hello, Peter.
Right, you suggested that I take it back to the shop and ask them if they'll take it back, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. They wouldn't.
Yeah.
I wandered off and carried on living my life. And then one day, now this is where the story really starts. That's a line from the Goon Show. I was wandering past and I thought, I wonder if I could fit an external hard drive to it and use that as the main drive. Yep. So I wandered in and I asked them. They said, no, you can't do that. And I said, you know, I was a fool in a hurry when I bought that. I just wish I could hand it back and use it as part payment for a new one. Now, this is where the story really starts. They said, oh, we'll see what you can do. I've got a new laptop.
Excellent.
Excellent. So, and you used it as part payment for the new laptop.
I did, yes. And this one's all singing, all dancing is fantastic.
Great. Is it working? Never mind all singing, all dancing. Is it working?
It does that as well.
That's good.
Peter, can I ask you, your old laptop, was it an Acer Cloud Book, yes?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and so those, I don't know what you paid for it. I think they were sort of £200-ish
It was reduced. I paid about 140 for it.
Okay, that's a good price. And how much credit did you get towards your new laptop?
I got the full amount.
You got the full 140?
Yep.
That's a bargain.
That's very good.
What you should then have done, Peter...
I sold it for 200 because the price went up.
Peter, you should have then offered them 30 quid for the cloud book.
I don't want it. I would only use it as a doorstop.
I was going to say a doorstop. Well, you know, 30 quid for a decorative doorstop is not bad, I think.
Fevzy, I think you're living in a different world. I think you're opening yourself up to all sorts of... That Fevzy spends 30 quid on doorstops.
On doorstops, yeah. I've spent more than that on doorstops, believe me.
So this is where the story really starts.
I'm glad it worked for you.
It sounds great, you know. I mean, what a success story.
And can I ask you what you bought? What laptop you bought?
Lenovo G50/80, I think it is.
Okay, and that's running, presumably that's running Windows 10?
Yes, it's got USB 3 webcam, a Core i3, whatever that is.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty good. So that's an upgrade, because your old cloud book would have been a Celeron processor, I think, wouldn't it? It would have been a slower processor. So the i3 is kind of like the entry level of a series of decent processors. So it is also decent. There's
the i3. Yeah, but it's still faster than the cloud book was.
It will be, yeah. i3, i5 and i7. How much RAM has it got inside it, may I ask?
4 gig.
Excellent, because your old one had about 2, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm going to put another 4 in. And I'm going to swap the hard drive for an SSD.
Okay.
These are all good plans.
All sounds good. I'd start... both of those are good. Start with the RAM. See how you go. That's the simplest one to do. And just make sure that you do it in a way that doesn't invalidate your warranty. Yeah, don't break any seals on the screws or anything
that. I bought an extended warranty. I think it's guaranteed against fools like me.
Well... be careful, because even extended warranties can be invalidated.
Yes.
I mean, it shouldn't be the case that, you know, swapping out an SSD should not invalidate your warranty, because if it all goes pear-shaped, you just swap the old drive back into it and then take it back. But if you've
pear-shaped's
broken...
Pear-shaped's good for a doorstop.
Yeah, but if you've broken, you just offer for a swap. You just could do this every few months, couldn't you, really? Just make sure that, for example, if you're unscrewing, some manufacturers put... little seals over the screws, so the only way to unscrew it is to break the seal, and then they know
you've been
inside. But generally speaking, people do, you know, upgrade their machines and don't expect their warranty to be killed. But you should just check that, because it's a brand new machine. It would be a shame to do away with the warranty straight away. The good news is these solid state drives are just dropping and dropping in price. You know, what sort of capacity were you looking for?
Well, I'm not bothered because I don't use much storage space. I've got a 120 gig that I might just slip in.
Yeah, I mean, I think the prices are such that a 256 is probably the sweet spot at the moment in terms of, you know, because you don't... It would just be a little bit tight, because don't forget, what you'll do is you'll probably partition that drive into a C drive and a D drive, so the C drive will contain the operating system. You need to leave enough space on that partition so you can install as many programs as you want, because they'll go on the C drive as well. And you need to have enough space for what's called the swap file, so that's like the temporary scratch file, the temporary storage that the operating system uses when it hasn't got enough RAM. Rather than say I give up, it starts using hard drive space as if it were RAM. So you need to have a big fast swap file. So I would say to you that, you know, given the price of a 256 gig drive, you could probably get for less than £60.
Probably
a good deal. If you look out for deals, you know, you can do a lot better than that. You might even go down to about 40. I don't think.
What make would you recommend?
Do you know what? There are many good brands. Samsung are probably, you know.
Yeah, I like Samsung.
Best known for their SSDs at the moment. But, you know, I won't say it's impossible to buy a bad SSD, but it's quite difficult these days. I mean, most of them are quite decent. Just make sure that you get a current one. You know, because there are some older ones around, and the current ones have a number of advantages, not just in terms of speed, but in terms of longevity as well.
Peter in Cramlington in Northumberland, thank you very much indeed for your call. Dennis in London. Dennis, hello there. You've got a new mobile and you've got problems with an upgrade.
Yes. Good morning. What actually happened was I decided I would go from a Doro Oyster, you know, which didn't have internet, to a Doro 8030. Mm-hmm. I'm of the generation which isn't particularly tech savvy, and that sounds like a good idea to me once I'd researched which would be the best for me. Went into an O2 store today. I bought the 8030 on the basis that they would set the phone up for me and leave my old phone safe, that's the tech term I use anyhow. So I was there for about 20 minutes while the woman behind the counter messed with both phones. She said, one, that the new phone wouldn't take the old SIM card from my Oyster phone, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But during the course of this, while she was dealing with the new, the old phone and the SIM card, the manager called her in behind the store, and I was quite concerned about that. Why go in with my phone and my SIM card at the same time? She came back out again, did everything. I took the phone home. She said it should be okay. Her advice was... turn it off when you get home and then turn it on again and everything should come up. When I got home, I found that my photo gallery, which was quite sentimental for me, was missing, and that I kept getting mobile network not available. It hasn't worked at all.
Okay. So what explanation was given to you about the SIM card?
The only thing to do was to go in tomorrow morning again. What I'm really saying is, one, they didn't give me the old SIM card in any way, Would that have remained in the Oyster phone? Would they have put it back in there?
One wonders what they did. I mean, I'm assuming that the compatibility issue was that the old phone took a... So SIM cards come in three sizes.
She did say it was too big, too small to go in the new phone.
So there's a number of ways around that. Some SIM cards, although they're big, have got press-out sections where you can actually press them out, and there's a small... It's like those Russian dolls, you know, one within the other, so you can actually push out to the size that you want. Another alternative is you use another SIM card, physical SIM card, and then through the network get that SIM card to be associated with your phone number.
It seemed to me she took out, you know, the little cardboard... folder thing and pressed a new SIM card.
A brand new SIM card. Okay, so it sounds like what she did was, as you say, put in a brand new SIM card, and then that's what the switching on and off is meant to do. It's meant to be the final step in associating your phone number with that SIM card. Mm-hmm. The SIM card on a modern phone doesn't do much. I mean, there is a small amount of memory on a SIM card, so you can store contacts and so forth on it. But for the most part, people use the internal memory of the phone to store data because it's more capacity. So that sounds like what she did. But what I'm curious to know is, you said you lost photos and so forth. Now these will have been almost certainly, were they stored in the cloud or were they stored physically on your old phone?
They were physically on my old phone.
Okay, and did you expect that they would have transferred that information from the old phone?
Yes, at one point she did show me on the new phone, she asked me to check that they were there.
Yeah.
But when I got home, they weren't there.
Are they still on the old phone?
The old phone doesn't work at all.
So it was already dead when she did the transfer, is that right?
Well, as far as I was concerned, she was transferring everything from the old phone onto the new one.
So sorry, Dennis, let me just clear this in my own mind. I'm sorry if I haven't picked it up completely.
I'm not very technically gifted.
It is complex. There's a lot going on.
But so you know, not to take too long with this, but you bought the new phone because the old phone had died, or just because you wanted a more advanced phone?
No, because I wanted to avail myself of the internet when I travel. Okay.
So as far as we know, the old phone was not faulty. It was just
old phone, but it was simply a calls and text.
And is the old phone now unable to switch on, or is it simply that it no longer has an active SIM in it and therefore it's not working to make calls?
I'm not absolutely sure because I don't know where the old SIM card is.
Right. Okay. So I suspect it is that. I suspect that because there can
only... SIM card in it.
Either no SIM card or the SIM card's been deactivated in order that the number could be transferred to the new smaller SIM card taken by the Doro 8030. So probably the phone is fine. The SIM card is actually only really a billing tool for most purposes.
Yeah.
You know,
that's why
even a phone without a SIM card can still make an emergency call. The SIM card isn't required to make and receive calls other than that it's necessary for the company to be able to bill you for those calls. And therefore, even with a deactivated SIM card, you should still be able to start up that phone, make sure it's fully charged, start it up and back it up. Yeah. And I'd go into them and just ask them to, before they do anything else, just to back it up for you.
Back up the old phone.
Yeah. And then once they've done the backup and given it to you, then if you trust them to, then ask them to try again to transfer that much beloved data. Failing that, you can go to a third party, but as they've sold you the phone, I'd go with them, because if you go to a third party at this stage and it still doesn't work, one will blame the other.
I've told them unless I can go in tomorrow and they can set up the new phone to my satisfaction, that I can do the very basics that I will require, the deal to be called off. That's fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, did you take a contract with them when you...
No, I'm doing pay-as-you-go.
It's just pay-as-you-go. Yeah, so you should be able to to cancel that if you're not
but
satisfied.
But the fact that
it.
Mobile network not available keeps coming up means that it hasn't been set up properly. Is that correct? Or that I'm incompetent in the very basics?
No, Dennis, nothing you've said leads me to think that you're in any way incompetent. So it could be also that the network that you've got your pay-as-you-go SIM with may not have a strong enough signal in your area. So that's also true, because this is often an issue. I recently had it happen to myself. I took a contract. Oh. I took a contract with a company, and before doing that, I checked on that network's website to see what the signal strength in my location should be. I then checked the Ofcom maps for the same information. I was on each occasion I was told I'd get 4 to 5 bars of signal. In reality, I got 0 to 1 bar of signal, such that even incoming calls were diverting straight to voicemail when I was sitting right next to the phone and it was switched on. So it could be a problem with signal. If it's a problem with signal, then you've obviously got the right to get a refund on that.
Well, I'm showing no bars on the signal at the top of the phone. Yeah.
So it's either that you're in a poor reception area, try it in another area to see if it improves it, or that the SIM card has not correctly activated. But yeah, that should not stop you getting to photo content on the phone, which leads me to think that transfer didn't take place properly. Dennis, I hope that's of some help.
Thank you very much. I shall go in and do battle in the morning.
Yes, and just if it's not going the way you like, just mention that we've spoken here and that we'll probably speak again about this.
I shall do. Thank you very much for that. Okay.
Cheers, Dennis. Bye-bye.
John in Maldon in Essex. Hello there, John.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hello, John.
I understand you're using a screen reader and you're having a few problems. What's the situation?
Well, I'm totally blind and I use a screen reader. And I've recently upgraded to Windows 10 from 7.8. Yep. But I understand there's a program out there called Classic View, which if I download, will put the 10, Windows 10, back to giving the appearance of a Windows 7. Is this so, and does it work successfully? Because Windows 7 was so much easier to negotiate from the start menu.
Yeah. I haven't used Classic View, John, but there are programs that do what you describe, and none of them will do it perfectly. Are you using JAWS?
I am, yeah.
You're using the JAWS screen reader program. And is that not yet... So that is compatible with Windows 10, so the issue is that everything is in a different place now.
It's everything is in a different place and not so easily found. I suppose if Classic View, Classic Shell is not that good, then it's down to me to get used to the...
Yeah. I mean, I think the short answer is because... This is to some extent a personal judgment as well as to how acceptable it is to you. I would try Classic View. I don't think there's any great harm in trying it if you're able to either load it yourself or have someone load it for you, and just try it out on a trial basis and see if it works for you. Often with these things that, you know, it gives the appearance of your Windows 7, but then in certain areas it's still not quite right, and therefore... on the face of it, it will have the look and feel. You know, the start button will give you the start menu, and it'll look like the old one. I think in the long term, even if Classic View is all right when you run it, I would start to try in your spare time to try and get used to it without, and to adapt to Windows 10, because you know Windows 10 is the current operating system. It is the future. And at some point, you know, operating systems change. I mean, you can imagine you wouldn't want to be, you know, still trying to make your machine emulate Windows 3.1 or something. So there will come a point when you need to bite the bullet. But as a transitionary sort of phase, that's probably not a bad idea to try that and just make sure that you can continue to do what you need to do day to day whilst maybe putting aside, you know, 20 minutes a day or something just to get used to Windows 10. It is a bit of a culture shock for the sighted as well, I can tell you, because it is different. To some extent, it sort of went back more towards Windows 7 than Windows 8 and 8.1. Because 8 and 8.1 were widely rejected for being too different. And the problem with both you know, 8.1 and indeed 10 is that they're trying to be all things to all people. They're trying to be tablet operating systems as well as desktop operating systems. And that gives rise to problems. You know, it's trying to be a jack of all trades in that sense.
I think what I'll do then is I'll persevere, because actually next month I have the latest JAWS version running, but next month JAWS 18 comes out, so
yeah,
that might solve some issues in itself.
Might yeah. help, yeah.
And the thing is, John, if you're using things like Classic View, this sort of like shell layer that sort of makes Windows appear to be different, the problem is every time there's an upgrade to Windows, you know, it may break the software, it may start not working or behaving erratically. So it's better to run as standard an installation as you can. But as I say, with the caveat is if you need something like that as an interim measure, fine. Or you know, it depends on how critical your day-to-day tasks are, and if you've got the time to spend an extra half an hour looking for a feature that you knew where it was in 7. But as
I'm retired now, so I can play around, can't I?
Well, then I would say just, you know, try and go with Windows 10, because then you're running the operating system in the way that it's meant to be run, and in the long run it will probably give you fewer problems doing it that way.
Thanks very much for your help,
John. You're welcome, thank you, John. For your Cheers. Call. That's lovely. Thanks for your time. Now, Adil in Oxford. Hi there, Adil. You're trying to get photos off an old Nokia phone. How old is it?
Yes, it's not very old. It's an X. I think it's called X5 Nokia phone. It's about 4 or 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And about 4 years ago, the charging mechanism where the battery connects with the phone, it physically was damaged.
Yes.
And I couldn't charge the phone, so it went dead. But I've got some photos in the phone, and I was wondering whether I'm still able to retrieve them.
Yeah. So the. The X5, was it the X501, the one with the QWERTY keyboard at the bottom and the sort of sliding screen on top?
It
doesn't have that one. Okay. No. Was this a Symbian phone? Did it run the Symbian operating system? Symbian.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
If you are lucky, you can attach it to first of all. Does the phone have a micro SD card slot in it?
It does, yes.
Right. So the simplest thing to do would be to, if the photos are not already stored on the card but are stored on the internal memory, to use. Can you still fire up the phone at all, or is it completely dead?
No, I can't fire it up. No.
Okay. Do you know if the photos are on the SD card or on the internal memory?
I think they are in the internal memory.
Okay. And the problem is that the fault in the phone is that it can't take power because the
yes.
connector is there.
So that's correct.
And if the charge is all gone and you can't take power and it's on the internal memory, the only way to short of, you know, a very expensive process of you know, taking the chips out and loading them into a working equivalent machine, which would be very expensive, the only way to do it is to repair the phone and give it power again, because if it was on the card, it's worth checking the card, by the way. You may have a pleasant surprise, but
yeah.
if you haven't already done so. If it's on the internal memory, then the only way to access the internal memory is for that machine and the operating system on that machine to fire up and access it, because even if you were to plug it into an external machine and try and access it as an external drive, it will require the machine to power up to appear as an external drive. So that's the only real way of doing it, is to effect at least a temporary repair. You know, a lot of phone repairers could do a makeshift repair, you know, with a soldering iron. They might just be able to get it running long enough to power it up, charge it, and transfer the images off it. And, you know, depending on what that's worth to you, that might cost you, you know, £40-50, if assuming it's,
yeah.
it's a straightforward thing. And, you know, you won't, it should be possible, because you won't necessarily need to replace the parts. Yeah, it would depend on how much damage has been done. Often the charger port is the most vulnerable part, because it causes a flexing in the main circuit board, and which can cause, you know, more serious damage. But sometimes it's just the socket itself that needs to be resoldered. So you could take it to somewhere and try and do an agreement with them based on no photos, no payment.
Okay.
That's so why.
The photos, even after 4 years, in the internal memory, they will still survive.
They could survive. It's not definite, because it depends. If there's been sort of if there's been power spikes going through the phone, it could have corrupted it. But in principle, it could still be there.
It's a bit of a gamble, though, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It depends how precious the pictures are and how much you want to risk spending to try and retrieve them.
Adil in Oxford, thanks very much indeed for your calls. Favzi, thank you very much indeed for your time. Just tell us a bit more about your website.
www.gadgetdetective.com. There's a free tech advice forum there.
And, of course, there are other tech websites available. And we'll be talking to Favzi again in the next few weeks. You're listening to Up All Night here on 5 Live.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.